Howdy, Zach here with a quick reminder about the Veritas Forum. On February 20th, 2020, we will be hosting Dr. Joshua Swamidas and Dr. Michael Behe in conversation about God and or evolution. It will be at 7 p.m. on February 20th in Rudder Theater. Please get your tickets now at txag/Veritas2020. That's tx.ag/Veritas2020. Tickets are currently live and they are free. If you are listening from the future, no worries. Go to txag/Veritas2020, and that will take you to an audio recording of the discussion. All right, now back to the episode.
Open your Bibles and turn on your brains. It's time for the Think Theism Podcast.
Can the existence of God be demonstrated?
I'm convinced that there are better arguments for theism than for atheism.
Any contradiction between the existence of evil and God's being holy, good, and
the biggest difference, of course, winds up being who is Jesus and what role does he have?
Our speaker for this talk is Father Robert Verrill. He is an ordained Dominican priest from Baylor University. He has a doctorate in mathematics, and his latest research project has been integrating contemporary theoretical physics with the doctrine of Thomism. His talk is entitled Thomas Aquinas and Quantum Theory. Now, at numerous times throughout the talk, Father Verrill will refer to his slide deck. Now, if you look in the show notes, I've actually linked to a handout of all of the slides, as well as a transcript of the complete talk. All right, now, without any further ado, here is Father Robert Verrill.
For some people, the title Aquinas and Quantum Theory might sound like a rather strange title for a talk. If you know anything about St. Thomas Aquinas at all, you probably know that he lived in the 13th century, whereas people have only been studying quantum theory from the 20th century onward. Indeed, the year of Aquinas' birth, 1225, is almost 700 years before the German physicist Max Born coined the term quantum mechanics in a 1924 paper. If you know a little bit more about Aquinas, you'll also know that he believed in a geocentric cosmos with the Earth at the centre, which was itself contained by a number of celestial spheres, each of whose motion was governed by an angel. Aquinas also believed that there were only four elements in the sublunar realm, namely earth, air, fire, and water, and that the celestial angels were able to fashion the vast array of living things in the world out of these four elements via the so-called seminal powers. Needless to say, this is not how scientists understand the world today. So why might we therefore wonder what possible relevance Aquinas' understanding of the cosmos could have to quantum theory? Well, I think the very fact that Aquinas was interested in the contemporary physics of his day should give us pause for thought. Aquinas was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Catholic theologians in the history of the Church, and so we should be asking ourselves, why would a Catholic theologian be interested in physics? Now, with regard to this question, two answers come to mind. Firstly, there are some people out there who think that physics contradicts the Christian faith. Now, since it is impossible for two truths to contradict one another, Catholic theologians and Christian theologians, or at least some of them, should be trying to offer interpretations of physics that are compatible with the Christian faith. Thus Aquinas writes in the opening question of his Summa Theologiae, since faith rests upon infallible truth, and since the contrary of a truth can never be demonstrated, it is clear that arguments brought against the faith cannot be demonstrations, but are difficulties that can be answered. Therefore, following the example of Aquinas, there should be at least some theologians who are willing to listen to the difficulties a contemporary physicist might have with the doctrines of the Christian faith. And once these difficulties have been properly understood, the theologian should strive to find ways in which they might resolve these difficulties. But even if there weren't physicists raising difficulties that need addressing, I think there is still a reason for theologians to be interested in physics. And this is because of the incarnation, the fact that God became incarnate, taking on our physical nature, should have consequences for how theologians think about physical reality. Our faith is a faith not solely concerned with the life to come, but it is also concerned with our life on earth, here and now. So in the light of the Incarnation, I think we can hope to bear some spiritual fruits through our contemplation of physical reality. For instance, both theologians and physicists say a lot about light. Now, although theologians speak of light in different ways, these ways aren't entirely unrelated to the way in which physicists speak of light. From a personal point of view, I've found that studying the physics of light has made me be much more attentive to how often light is mentioned in Scripture and in the prayers of the Divine Office. Now, the purpose of my talk tonight is really just to present an interpretation of quantum theory that is inspired by the thoughts of St. Thomas Aquinas. But before I do that, I'll just say a little bit more about the first answer to my question as to why a theologian would be interested in physics, that is, the desire to resolve difficulties people might have with the Christian faith. So here is a picture of the physicist and Nobel laureate Steven Weinberg, who is famous for his theory that unified electromagnetism and the weak interaction force. He is also an atheist, who said, among other things, that the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. I've also listed on this slide some of the views a physicist might have that could lead to difficulties in accepting the Christian faith. So the first view that I think can lead to difficulties is the view that atomism gives a complete account of physical reality. Atomism is a very attractive view to physicists. For instance, the physicist Richard Feynman writes in the first lecture of his lecture series in physics, "If in some cataclysm all of scientific knowledge were to be destroyed and only one sentence passed on to the next generation of creatures, what statement would contain the most information in the fewest words? I believe it is the atomic hypothesis that all things are made of atoms, little particles that move around in perpetual motion, attracting each other when they are little distance apart, but repelling upon being squeezed into one another. In that one sentence, there is an enormous amount of information about the world, if just a little imagination and thinking are applied." Now, as Feynman says, the atomic hypothesis does indeed have a great amount of explanatory power. But if we take this hypothesis too literally and suppose that it gives us a complete account of physical reality, then it raises the question of where we as human beings fit into this account. According to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, man, though made of body and soul, is a unity. Through his very bodily condition, he sums up in himself the elements of the material world. Now, if atomism really were a complete account of physical reality, then it would follow that atomism could account for the behaviour of the physical reality of the human body. And so there wouldn't seem to be any role for the soul to play in governing the behaviour of the human body. Atomism can therefore make the soul seem rather redundant. And so people who embrace this view may conclude that they don't actually have souls. Such people may therefore find it very difficult to accept the Catholic faith, given that the central mission of our faith is the preaching of the gospel for the salvation of souls. The second view that I think can lead to difficulties with the Christian faith is that view that the whole of physical reality is deterministic. This view might not seem so widespread with the advent of quantum theory, but there are still interpretations of quantum theory, such as the many worlds interpretation and the Bohmian interpretation of quantum theory, that are deterministic. Now, determinism leads to difficulties with Christian faith because of the importance the Christian faith gives to human freedom and because of the difficulty of reconciling human freedom with physical determinism. For instance, in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it says that man cannot live fully according to truth unless he freely acknowledges God's love and entrusts himself to his Creator. But the physicist who embraces determinism might well ask, in what sense can we freely acknowledge God's love if the whole of physical reality is predetermined so that we are not free to do anything apart from what we actually do? Now, there are some people who argue that determinism and freedom are in fact compatible after all. But personally, I think that this is a rather difficult position to maintain. And so I think that by adopting compatibilism, we'd just be relocating the difficulty that determinism presents to the Christian faith. The third view that can lead to difficulties, and is really the contrary to the second view I've just presented, is that all physical reality is fundamentally random. This view does not deny that there are regular patterns in nature, but rather that these regular patterns can be explained entirely in terms of randomness. For instance, the fact that heat typically flows from hot bodies to cold bodies can be explained in terms of random motion of particles. Now, randomness in itself does not present a challenge to the Christian faith. For instance, Aquinas himself was perfectly willing to acknowledge that things could happen by chance. However, randomness does present a challenge to the Christian faith if we try to reduce all physical explanations to randomness. For as Christians, we believe that we can order our human actions to certain ends, and that through the grace of God, we can order all the human actions of our lives towards eternal beatitude. But if the whole of physical reality is fundamentally random, then it seems that it would just be a convenient fiction to suppose that people really are capable of acting in a purposeful manner towards ends. And the fourth view that can lead to difficulties is the idea that physical reality is fundamentally weird. Now, the fact that some aspects of physics might seem rather weird doesn't necessarily pose a challenge to the Catholic faith. For instance, time dilation in special relativity and wave particle duality in quantum theory may at first appear rather weird to us, but this is only because we don't have that much experience of travelling close to the speed of light or observing phenomena at the quantum scale. However, there are some kinds of weird hypotheses that I think would present a challenge to the Christian faith. For instance, many people think that the Schrödinger's cat thought experiment implies that a cat could be in a state in which it is both actually alive and actually dead. Now, the conclusion which appears to draw from this thought experiment is not saying anything about extreme situations, but rather it is saying something about our current situation, that the principle of non-contradiction can sometimes be violated. Originally, this thought experiment was invoked to highlight the problems inherent in quantum theory, but it has become increasingly common for popularizers of quantum physics to proclaim this weird conclusion as an established fact. Another related view, which is not quite so radical as to reject the principle of non-contradiction, but is still pretty radical all the same, is the view that there are no local matters of fact, such as the fact that a particular cat is dead or alive. Instead, there is just one universal matter of fact, that is, there is just one subject of predication, namely the universal quantum wave function. Now, the mathematics behind this view is indeed very elegant, and this elegance might explain why some physicists might subscribe to this view despite it undermining the very possibility of doing physics as a science in the first place. But in any case, this view is obviously incompatible with the Christian faith. For instance, according to this view, it would strictly speaking be incorrect to say that at a particular point in time and at a particular location on earth, Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Now, in this talk, I'm not particularly interested in trying to convince the stubborn skeptic. If people really don't want to believe in the revealed truths of the Christian faith, then they will always find some reason not to believe. But in this talk, I'm much more interested in helping people who want to believe the revealed truths of the faith and are trying to make sense of them in the modern world. To this end, I'm interested in considering interpretations of quantum physics that do appear to be compatible with what we believe as Christians. And one of the interpretations I'm investigating and expanding upon in my doctoral thesis is a very recent interpretation by the physicist Adrian Kent. Now, Kent's interests are entirely different from my own. As one of the papers which describes his interpretation suggests, Kent is interested in finding a solution to the Lorentzian quantum reality problem. Now, you don't need to know exactly what this problem is, but only that if Kent's solution really worked, it would be a big deal. Indeed, the philosopher of physics Jeremy Butterfield is so excited by Kent's proposal that he wrote a survey paper titled Peaceful Coexistence, examining Kent's relativistic solution to the quantum measurement problem. I mention Butterfield's paper because he offers one of the most accessible accounts of Kent's interpretation, if you're at all interested in learning more about it. So why do I think that Kent's interpretation of quantum physics might have anything to do with St. Thomas Aquinas' understanding of reality? Well, the reason I think this is because back in 2018, I presented at a poster session at a philosophy of physics summer school in Chicago, and my presentation was titled Hylomorphism and the Superposition of Cat States. Now, hylomorphism is an Aristotelian theory that St. Thomas Aquinas subscribed to, and it is about the composition of physical things. Hylomorphism posits that all physical things are a composite of two principles, namely matter and form, matter being the thing's principle of potency, and form being the thing's principle of actuality. And in my Chicago presentation, I tried to make the case that the superposition of cat states is not as weird as it sounds, so long as you make the distinction between potency and actuality. And I went on to give some details on what this distinction would mean in the context of quantum physics. Now, one of the other participants at this philosophy of physics workshop found out what I was working on, and he recommended that I read about Adrian and Kent's interpretation of physics, and he pointed me in the direction of Jeremy Butterfield's paper. Now, although there are a number of differences between Kent's interpretation and my own, when I learned about his interpretation, I saw that there was something I could clearly build upon. I was particularly impressed by the role that light played in Kent's interpretation in determining the unfolding of a one-world history. Now, I don't know what Kent's religious beliefs are, and I suspect that he has little knowledge of Aristotle or Aquinas. But whatever Kent believes, I'm only trying to show that his interpretation of physics is consistent with a Thomistic philosophy of nature rather than entailing a Thomistic philosophy of nature. But today, I'm not simply going to repeat the presentation I made in Chicago, mainly because I want to say something a little bit more theological. So I want to share with you some of the pious speculation that was at the back of my mind when I was putting my Chicago presentation together. So let's think about the divine nature. Aquinas famously said that we cannot know what God is, but rather only what God is not. So we need to be aware of our inability to grasp God's nature when we are doing theology. That is, when we speak about God, we don't really know what we are talking about. Nevertheless, this doesn't stop us from speculating about the nature of created reality in the light of what we think about God. So here are some beliefs that Aquinas held about God. Firstly, God is the first cause, that is, God is the cause of all creation, but nothing is the cause of him. From this it follows that God is simple. In other words, any kind of composition you can think of does not apply to God, since every composition depends on its parts, but God does not depend on anything. Thus, God is not a body, he is not composite of matter and form, and he is not any other kind of composite that you can think of. God also creates freely. He doesn't have to create, for he is perfect in himself. The only reason he needs for creating things is that created things are good. That is, created things reflect the goodness of God's own being. God is also eternal. Aquinas, following Boethius' definition of eternity Aquinas, following Boethius, defines eternity to be the simultaneously whole and perfect possession of interminable life. So in God, there is no process in which he thinks about one thing and then thinks about another. That is, there is no succession of before and after in God. Rather, there is just one single act of knowing in God. And this single act of knowing is interminable insofar as it does not have a beginning and it doesn't have an end. And in this single eternal act of knowing, God perfectly knows everything there is to know. So he eternally knows his own being perfectly, and he eternally and necessarily knows every way in which his being can be imitated. For instance, for all eternity, God has known about human nature, for beings such as ourselves imitate the being of God, but God didn't need to create human beings to find this out. So let's now reflect on God's single act of knowing in a little bit more detail. Now, I have to caveat what I'm about to say as being somewhat controversial. This is my own interpretation of Aquinas, so there are likely to be many Thomists who disagree with some of the things that I say. But that said, concerning God's knowledge, there are some things that God knows necessarily, and there are some things that God knows contingently. Aquinas refers to the principle of God's knowledge of things as they existed in God's mind as divine ideas. By divine simplicity, since everything that is in God is God, the divine ideas are identical to the one divine essence. Also, because there are many things that God knows, Aquinas argued that there must be many divine ideas in the mind of God. Now, with our limited minds, we can't comprehend how God can both be simple and how there can be many divine ideas in God's mind. All we can say in this regard is that God's having many ideas doesn't entail that there is any composition in God. And so, as I said, the many divine ideas in God must be identical with the one divine essence. And we can also say that God necessarily has divine ideas because God necessarily knows what he can do. So we can say that the divine ideas necessarily flow, so to speak, from God's own self-understanding. Now, the word flow might be a little bit misleading, since God is entirely immutable and non-changing. Nevertheless, by using the word flow, I'm trying to capture the sense that there is an eternal and unchanging dynamism within the mind of God. Now, God can do more than just think about the ways in which his being can be imitated. God can also think about particular individual things that imitate his being. God does not have to think about individual things, for he knows everything intelligible there is to know about individual things prior to their creation. As an analogy, or for the contingent aspect of God's thinking, we can consider our own knowledge of something like right-angled triangles. In our own case of understanding, before we come to understand Pythagoras' theorem, we need to consider many, many triangles to understand this theorem. However, once we understand what a right-angled triangle is and how to apply Pythagoras' theorem to it, we don't learn anything more about Pythagoras' theorem after seeing many more right-angled triangles. Now, God, in his perfect act of knowledge, eternally understands Pythagoras' theorem, and so he is like us in having this understanding, and he doesn't gain any further insight into Pythagoras' theorem by then considering lots more individual triangles. But unlike us, God doesn't need to consider any individual triangles in the first place to gain this understanding, for God's single act of knowing is perfect and eternal. Now, when God thinks of individual things, he does not act without reason, for to do so would be irrational, and God is not irrational. But God does have a reason for thinking about individual things, namely because it's good to think about individual things. So we can say of the things that God knows in his single act of knowing, that some of these things he knows necessarily, and that some of these things he knows contingently. The things God knows necessarily through his divine ideas belong to his divine essence, whereas the things God knows contingently are the individual things that imitate his essence and do not belong to his divine essence. So when God thinks of individual things other than himself, it is not as though he is thinking of them as possible individuals and then deliberating on whether or not to create them. Rather, creation just is God thinking about individual things other than himself. So in God's single act of knowing, God freely creates the things he does, and we can go on to suppose that the things he creates are free to act as they will, insofar as they are expressions of God's own freedom to act. In other words, the freedom of individual things is really identical to the freedom of God to contingently think them into existence. So, how does all this theological speculation connect with quantum physics? Well, first I'll have to tell you a little bit about quantum physics itself. So let's start with a very basic interpretation of quantum physics, namely the Copenhagen interpretation. Probably the most famous experiment that demonstrates quantum effects is the double slit experiment. In this experiment, one fires electrons through a double slit. Now, electrons are particles, so when they hit the detection screen, they are detected at point-like locations. However, somewhat remarkably, these point-like locations are not uniformly spread out, but rather they occur in fringes, which suggests that there are two waves emerging from the double slits, which interfere with one another. And one can calculate a wave function to accurately specify the likelihood that electrons will be measured at a particular location. To model this, quantum physicists suppose that there is an initial quantum state psi. What this means is that if you look at a possible location x at which the particle might be detected, you can form a quantity, namely the bracket of x and psi. And this quantity is also written as psi of x. And if you square it, it gives you the probability that the particle is in state psi. In state psi will be detected at location x. Now this rule is called the Born rule. Furthermore, it is supposed that if you know what the state psi is at a given time, then you can work out what the state will be after a time t later. For instance, if you know the state of the particle at the beam gun, and then let's say at time t0, then by solving the Schrodinger equation, you can calculate the state ut of psi. Might not be able to see it very clearly. This is a ut of psi there. So you can calculate that using the Schrodinger equation. And this will tell you at time t, or when you would expect the particle to have reached the screen. And with this, you see how this formalism helps you to predict the probability distribution of the measurements at the screen location. What you do is you'd consider the simpler case where you close off one slit, say the second one, and then calculate the state psi 1 of the particle just as it emerges from the first slit. And if you know how to do this, to calculate this state psi 1 of the particle, then you'll also know how to calculate state psi 2 of the particle that would emerge from the slit 2 if slit 1 was closed off. And then to find out what the state of the particle would be as it emerges when the double slit situation where both slits are uncovered, you would just add these two states together, and you had to multiply it by an appropriate normalization factor, which is this 1 over the square root of 2 in this case. Then when you evolve this state over time via the Schrodinger equation to find out what the state of the screen will be like when the particle reaches the detection screen, these two components of the state will interfere with each other, leading to the interference pattern. And if you want to calculate the probability distribution for the particles to end up at position x, you first calculate this quantity here, and which I've assumed that you've already evolved the state via the Schrodinger wave equation, and you evolve that to the time at which you want to make the measurement at the screen, and then you'd square it to find the probability via the Born rule. But I want to reiterate, in this situation, psi is just the state of a single particle state, but because it can be thought of as the sum of two states, psi 1 and psi 2, physicists describe this state, psi, as being a superposition of two states. Now, in the Copenhagen interpretation, it is assumed that psi is a complete description of the particle. In particular, this means that there is no matter of fact about where the particle actually is. That is to say, the wave function is not a measure of our ignorance of the exact particle's position. For in the Copenhagen interpretation, it is assumed that a particle is not really the kind of thing that has an exact position. So in a way, particle is a bit of a misnomer for what physicists are talking about in the Copenhagen interpretation. And so when the particle, when the position of the particle is measured, its state psi collapses to a much more localized state, which is the new complete description of the particle. But again, the particle's position still isn't localized to an exact position. The localized state to which it collapses is entirely random, except that it collapses to a location with a probability specified by the Born rule. So in this example, when the wave function looks like the first wave function, on measurement, the wave function is moderately likely to collapse to these positions and not very likely to collapse to these positions. Whereas for this other highly localized function, I can't get it out, just wondering when I can probably won't risk it. But for the other very highly localized wave function, it is not very likely to collapse to any of, it's likely to collapse to this position, but not very likely to collapse to these positions. Still, although the collapse is local, the random evolution of ut of psi before the collapse is completely deterministic, since the evolution is determined by the Schrodinger equation. So that's a little bit heavy going, but maybe some of you know a bit of quantum physics already. So now, so far, we've only been considering one particle systems. That is, although we've been considering the double slit experiment, in which we fire many, many electrons through the double slit, with the result that we get a distribution of measurement outcomes. For each individual measurement we make, we have only been considering the physics of a single particle. Now, if this was all quantum physics could do, then its applicability to the modern world, to our world, would be very restricted. So quantum theory, therefore, has to be able to deal with multi-particle systems. For instance, to model a two-particle state, one of whose particles is in the psi 1 state and the other particle in the psi 2 state, we can write the corresponding two-particle state like so. And this two-particle state gives rise to a wave function that is now a function of two locations. And via the Born rule, the square of this wave function will tell you the probability that two particles will be detected at locations x1 and x2. And as before, one can use the Schrodinger equation to work out how this state evolves over time. Now, quantum theorists generally presume that if you had a huge number of particles, say around 10 to the 26 of them, one might be able to construct the multiparticle state of something like a cat. However, in the Copenhagen interpretation, we do not want to suppose that there is any additional law of physics that comes into play when one has cat-wise configurations of particles, since if there were, then quantum theory would only be an approximation. Thus, it is supposed that although the cat state will continually collapse according to the Born rule as it is observed, it's just statistically very likely that the sequence of collapses will look to us like the behavior of a living cat. Now, the problem with the Copenhagen interpretation is the question of what happens when macroscopic states like cats are coupled to microscopic states such as radioactive nuclei. Schrödinger noted that in theory, if a cat were placed in a sealed box with a radioactive nucleus, which if decayed would release a deadly poison, then before the sealed box was opened, the cat-wise configuration of particles would enter into a superposition of particles configured in an arrangement that behaved like a living cat and of particles configured in an arrangement that behaved like a dead cat. So statistically, according to the Born rule, the cat-wise configuration of particles don't behave like cats at all. Only sometimes they might behave like cats, but sometimes they won't behave like cats. So another issue that troubled pioneers of quantum theory was the localized wave function behavior of particles. Although in quantum theory, a particle such as an electron would not have an exact position, it was still hoped that the wave function for the particle would still be fairly localized. However, if one considers a wave packet that describes a particle with the mass of an electron, and suppose that the initial width of this wave packet is about the width of a hydrogen atom, then if one solves the Schrödinger equation for this particle, one would find that in the space of a second, the wave packet would have spread to the width of 1,000 kilometers. Now, in recent decades, physicists have come up with a theory which is meant to save the appearances of quantum theory. This theory is called decoherence theory. Decoherence theory is very ingenious, though when one first learns about it, it also seems very weird. Advocates of decoherence theory realized you couldn't just treat electrons as isolated systems from the rest of the universe, and this is even more so the case when we're dealing with things like cats enclosed in boxes. Photons will continually interact with the system, and significant numbers of these photons will be flying off into outer space. Now, as the system wave packet spreads, the photons that interact with it will go into a superposition of states depending on where each of the photons interacts with the system. This is called entanglement. But if you were able to measure these photons, their location would determine the location at which they interacted with the system, and so the system would become localized again. Let's now consider the Schrödinger's cat experiment in the light of decoherence theory. That is, we now consider our model to include not only the radioactive nucleus, the poison, and the cat, but also to include Schrödinger conducting his experiment and his laboratory, and of course all the photons interacting with the laboratory and himself though in order that things don't become too cluttered, we'll suppress some of these elements. Now, in this scenario, although the wave function of the atom will spread fairly quickly, which I depict by subscripts 1 and 2, the photons will interact with the expanding wave function of the atom, and so the photons will become entangled with the atom in accordance with where the photons interact with the atom's wave function. So in this, there'd actually be very many, many more terms in this sum here. But also in the case of a radioactive atom, as in the case of as light interacts with it, the photons will also become entangled with the decayed and a non-decayed state of the atom. So we can depict this entanglement process as a branching process. So this is just really another way of saying how these states evolve. So really it's just a different picturing this process here we just say that they have the two combined states of the photons and the atoms have evolved from, this evolving from here to here is the same, it's just another, you can write it this way here. This is just a kind of pictorial representation of this process of interaction. And if we now consider including the cat into our model, then the photons will also interact with the cat and so become entangled with the cat, and this is regardless of whether the poison has been released or not. So just the fact that the cat is moving, there'll be photons, it'll be entering into superposition with it, getting entangled with all the photons. And there'll be a very high probability that some of these photons will fly off into outer space. And if we were to measure enough of these photons, we could work out the mass configuration and location of the cat. And photons will also interact with Professor Schrödinger. And the same story applies. But given enough time, the superposition state of the radioactive atom will lead to the following entangled state, where the happy face indicates that Schrödinger has opened the box and is delighted to see that the cat is alive, and the frowny face indicates that Schrödinger has opened the box and is disappointed to find that the cat has died. And again, if we wish, we could depict this process in our branching diagram, and if we wish, we could also include the lab in this depiction as well. So we have this huge sort of entanglement of particles through the interaction with the with all the photons. So I haven't completed this depiction on all the branches, but you can kind of figure out what the other branches would look like. You just kind of repeat the kind of same kind of story. Anyway, so we might even suppose that if the cat is alive to celebrate, Schrödinger might give the cat some creamy salmon-flavored cat licks or some moist seafood medley flavor cat treats. On the other hand, if the cat has died, Schrödinger might either make arrangements for burial at the local pet cemetery, or he may decide to purchase an urn in which to place the ashes of his deceased cat. And all the while, we need to remember that photons are interacting with these four different components. Everything's getting all entangled together. And so if we were to measure enough of the light that is coming off from this entangled state, one would be able to determine all of which of these scenarios actually occurred. Now, one might suppose that this story of branching goes on forever and ever, without any measurement ever actually being made. Now, this is the so-called many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. And although it does have a mathematical elegance to it, I still think it's pretty ridiculous. So what about Adrian Kent's interpretation of quantum theory? Well, he buys into all this decoherence theory and the role that light plays in it. But rather than embracing the many world interpretations, he supposes that as the universal wave function and the universe expands, it will become less and less likely for the light to interact with any other matter. So as you go infinitely far in the future, eventually all branching will cease. And so he supposes that at some notional time in the future, the location of all the light in the universe will be determined in some kind of notional measurement. And then from this end time determination, Kent argues that one would be able to determine a one world history corresponding to the location of all the light. And once, one of the nice things about light is that since it is massless, it doesn't spread out like particles, which do have mass. And so this nice property of light suggests that after a certain point in the evolution of the universe, if you determine the location of all the light, it is not going to noticeably, you're not going to get different results if then you measure things at a subsequent point. So in a way, there's a kind of Kent argues that there's going to be a sort of convergence to this principle. So this is how he can argue for there being this kind of notional measurement at an infinite time in the future, because the measurements will kind of converge to the same one world history. So would this interpretation of quantum physics be acceptable to a Thomist? Well, sorry. Yeah, so I think it could be acceptable to a Thomist. Well, let's consider what I said earlier about the divine nature and God's perfect act of knowledge. God, in his single act of knowing, as well as necessarily thinking all the ways in which his being can be imitated, can also contingently think of a particular beginning and a particular end. As I mentioned earlier, this contingent thinking of God is his act of creation. Now, the particular beginning is somewhat akin to the quantum state. In quantum physics, it is always supposed that there is an initial state, and from this state, one can work out all future possibilities via Schrödinger's equation. Now, God being God would, of course, instantly know all the possibilities that flowed from the particular beginning he conceived. And moreover, there would be a genuine ontology to the possibilities. That is to say, they are real possibilities that could happen at possible times. But in order to avoid the absurdity of the many worlds interpretation, we have to make the distinction between real possibilities and real actualities. So if God, in his creative act, only conceived this particular beginning without conceiving a particular end, creation would be completely devoid of form. So, for instance, there would be no cats or human beings, and the particles of physics would have no individuality. Of course, God would never conceive of a particular beginning without conceiving a particular end, because without a particular end, the particular beginning would be devoid of any real intelligibility. And this is, I think, is what quantum physicists are trying to do. They come up with this kind of completely weird and unintelligible account of reality when they try and think of a quantum wave function as explaining everything. So this is, but in Aristotelian language, God would only have conceived of a, but if this was the case, in Aristotelian language, God would only have conceived of a pure potency principle in conceiving a particular beginning. But nevertheless, given this particular beginning, if one could see into the mind of God, one would be able to see how probable it would be for the matter and light to be distributed in a certain way at possible times if one were to measure it. And this probability distribution would be consistent with the Born rule. And for the particular end, and so as for the particular end God contingently thinks, this is like an actualization of the light, so that the potentiality of all the light in the beginning state and the possibilities that flow from this beginning state is determined to determinate locations. And moreover, since once the light, the location of light is determined, one can determine the location of the matter which the light was entangled with. And one can then sort of determine the configuration of all the matter throughout history through this this way from looking at the light to figure out how it interacted with the matter to find out where things actually are in this one world history. And so among such configurations, there will be cat-wise and human-wise configurations of matter. And since God determines the location of all the light in such a way that this choice is consistent with the Born rule, what God determines is consistent with what we understand to be quantum physics. But we need to say more than this, for there is likely to be many, many possible matter and light configurations that are consistent with the Born rule. This is like what the Schrödinger cat experiment demonstrates. We suppose that God chooses a particular mass configuration because this mass configuration is in some way intelligible and reflects his own intelligible being. And this intelligible account of reality can be passed in such a way that the matter of the universe is passed into individual beings like cats and human beings. So speaking both metaphorically and literally, it's only in the light of its intelligibility that matter can truly be said to be actualized. God lights up his creation in an intelligible way. Moreover, there is an order to this intelligibility. By this I mean that when God lights up his creation, he sees a huge amount of information that has an order to it. So if he sees a configuration A, then it will follow that, in some cases, it will follow that he will have to have seen configuration B. But if he sees configuration B, it doesn't necessarily follow that he will have had to see configuration A. So for an example, if God sees me giving a talk at Texas A&M, he will also see me receiving an invitation to give a talk at Texas A&M. But if he sees me receiving an invitation to give a talk at Texas A&M, it doesn't necessarily follow that God will see me giving a talk at Texas A&M because I might decide I'm too busy to give this talk. But although God immediately sees all he sees in his single act of knowing, from our perspective, in this ordering of information, we see the ordering of time, of actual time, rather than just possible time. And so, as another example, one could consider the situation of Schrödinger and his cat experiment. In the previous diagram I drew, I considered a rather limited number of different responses Schrödinger might have made depending on whether the cat was found to be alive or found to be dead. However, I very much doubt it would violate quantum physics if, on discovering the cat to be alive, Schrödinger, contacted the local pet cemetery to inquire about burying his deceased cat, or alternatively, if the cat was found to be dead, then Schrödinger opened a packet of cat treats for his cat. So these seem like really strange possibilities, but I don't think they're ruled out by quantum physics. So, but although these possibilities wouldn't necessarily be ruled out by quantum physics, these possibilities by themselves would not be intelligible. Now, perhaps God would still choose to actualize one of these seemingly strange possibilities, but in order to discern the intelligibility of God's choice, we would need to consider a wider context. Say, for instance, if Schrödinger had finally gone insane, as trying to feed his dead cat would suggest, then maybe his insanity will provide the opportunity for a mental health nurse to shine with virtue as the nurse patiently nurses Schrödinger back to full health. So this is a way, maybe a higher way of imitating the being of God's goodness. But another, whatever way God chooses to configure the matter and light of the universe, there is an intelligible account of his choice, of the manner in which his choice imitates his intelligible being. So, in conclusion, I'll raise this final question. If we could transport Aquinas from his own time to our time and explain to him all the discoveries of modern physics, how might Aquinas suggest we could interpret quantum theory? Well, maybe he would just tell us to take our interpretation from the first few lines of the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that it was good. The end. Okay, thank you very much.
So we got about 15 minutes for Q&A.
So earlier on in the talk, when you were talking about how the sort of conventional quantum theory models work for single particles, mm-hmm. and sort of quickly become absurd as mm-hmm. you stretch the model out.
Yeah.
Do you think there are connections there with Gödel's incompleteness theorem?
I've never thought about it. Do you think about the incompleteness of describing physical reality in terms of quantum physics, or
specifically like that any mathematical model you can take can then be used to demonstrate its own incompleteness, like on its own terms.
Yeah, I mean, okay. I mean, it might be a way of I mean, it'd be I mean, I guess they're kind of coming from completely different angles. I guess sort of isn't Gödel thinking about the structure of self-referencing sentences or something like that, isn't
right.
it? And I mean, I guess it kind of made. I guess maybe maybe sort of you could think of Gödel as sort of supporting this kind of incompleteness of quantum theory. But I guess it's sort of coming from very different angles. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's kind of you can have I mean, but I think something about the Gödel's theorem is, with quantum theory, if you get kind of weird conclusions that contradict common sense, then there's a kind of a tendency to say, oh, well, so much for common sense, we just have to kind of embrace the absurdity. Whereas I think maybe Gödel's theorem is a bit kind of, I don't think people kind of, they do accept sort of the limitations of these axiomatic systems. So in a way, maybe Gödel's theorem is a kind of, I mean, it might. It, I mean, because maybe someone might say that that's even though they might. Someone might say that. Well, maybe physics isn't completely complete, but it's still pretty complete, apart from these kind of few kind of kind of strange contrived. Example. So they might say that the Gödel's incompleteness theorem is a bit sort of contrived. Maybe I don't know. But
well, what made me think of this was you saying you can stretch out these wave functions to get some absurdly huge wave function that is now describing the physicist describing the wave function.
Yeah.
That sort of nestedness revealing. The paradoxical nature of reducing it just to this system.
I mean, I guess it could be sort of self-referencing, but I guess it kind of be. I mean, I guess you can sort of eliminativists who kind of they might just sort of say. Maybe they say that really all kind of human thinking is just kind of. Gives you a way of sort of ultimately predicting people's behaviors and just kind of sort of there could be kind of ways that people are trying to get out of these things, but I mean I think there's a I mean there's certainly it just all this kind of quantum physicists sort of describing themselves. It just seemed a bit kind of it just seemed weird. I mean, but I guess there's kind of some people just want to they kind of revel in the weirdness and say that. Okay.
I might be a little confused. So when we have these branches between different possibilities, is it? And I'm saying it because But is it necessary that there the child of a branch is necessarily distinct from the child like of another branch? Is there a possibility of like merging, or is there?
In quantum theory, you can actually have if you're kind of thinking about things could actually kind of merge back into again on a kind of very small kind of. Like the quest. So there'll be some things that there's kind of no matter of fact about which slit the electron went through. So, and I don't see there's a problem with that. I mean, it's a kind of that's just kind of how things behave when God sort of actualizes reality, he doesn't kind of say I'm going to kind of actualize which trajectory this electron went along, but he's going to say he actualized intelligible things about the cat moves over here because there's food that will give it nourishment. So he's kind of there'll be all kind of possibilities when you place some cat treats in the vicinity of a cat, which will all kind of these possibilities that would be consistent with quantum theory, but God kind of in his contingent act of knowing, he sees some kind of intelligible one rather than just the cat suddenly dropping dead or kind of. Yeah. But there'd be all these kind of different possibilities. So I think that would be consistent with quantum theory. But God chooses something that is intelligible, and we might not be able to see the intelligibility on the immediate level. This is why I was trying to get to the idea of Schrödinger trying to feed his dead cat. But it doesn't. So some things might seem unintelligible on the sort of the small scale. We really have to go really far into the future to see the whole intelligibility. And so things like with the problem of suffering, when we see suffering sort of close up, we find, you know, how can this be intelligible? How can a loving God allow this to happen? But we have to go right to the end to see how suffering fits into his divine providence. So things like, you know, this is the opportunity for Christ to come incarnate and to redeem us and to show us his infinite love for us, so that we end up becoming far more reflecting the image of God through redemptive suffering than if nobody had ever suffered. So in a small context, we might not be able to see the intelligibility, but you have to go into the bigger context. So we have to go really right to the end of the time to see the full intelligibility of God's choice, why God chose to actualize the world as he did. And
okay. Would you characterize it as when God created the world, has he already actualized all of the actualities?
Yeah. So in a way, there's a kind of because from his perspective, he eternally knows. So it's not like he's kind of thinking, well, I'm going to do this, well, now I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do that. He instantly knows the whole of history in like one single instant. So it's not like there's any kind of process in God's sort of deliberating, shall I do this or shall I do that? It's just, so in a way, he kind of thinks of both the beginning and the end together. He doesn't think of them by thinking them together, he sees, in a way, things there's this potency by which things have their have their freedom, but God actualizes that and in a contingent way. So, but it's in a way that reflects his own intelligibility, his goodness, and it's really but from God's perspective, it's kind of like everything is just kind of instantaneous, just one single act of knowing. But from our perspective, there's an order to this, this actualization. So it's just like, just as I was trying to say that in God sees, because in God's act of creation, he contingently sees his creation. And so it doesn't necessarily, so some things that he sees, they're not necessary that he sees them, but they will be necessary that he sees them given some other kind of information, so that he and this kind of asymmetry that A might necessarily entail that he sees B, but seeing B doesn't necessarily entail that he sees A. This gives an order to what he contingently sees, and it's really from that I'm trying to argue that we get really what we mean by actual time rather than possible time. So in possible time, this is what quantum theorists are dealing with. You have a given situation and you can see what possibilities flow from that situation. But it's and these are real possibilities. It's not kind of when we talk about possibilities, it's not nothing, but it's not the same as actuality. So really it's God when he actualizes his creation, then he gives there is this distinction between actuality and possibility. It's kind of hard to explain, but it's something that it seems the most obvious thing in the world that's a real distinction between possibility and actuality. And I think it's only when we try and mathematize reality that we kind of lose sight of this distinction, because mathematics, it doesn't have this kind of notion of distinction between potency and act. And so when we try and mathematize reality, we lose sight of this distinction between possibility and actuality. But I think this is a way in which I think if you want to kind of save quantum theory from falling into kind of absurdity. I think this is a way in which we can avoid absurdity by making this distinction. So there's not really a cat that's both dead and alive. But this is a kind of a possibility. These are real possibilities that the cat could die or the cat could live.
We have time for about one more question.
Okay, so I'm trying to understand how the language of probability maps onto like real possibilities versus real actualities, because in normal quantum mechanics terms, like if you have spin up or spin down particle, or like cat alive, cat died, you'd say 50% chance, 50% of the other, and they always have to sum to be one.
Yeah.
And so like when you look at, like if you single out of one world history, like does that, you just say all of everywhere in that path is always, there's a probability of one that it's everywhere, or say take that first branch, is there still a 50%, you know, chance of each of those?
If you're kind of like, there's still, so when we're talking about, I guess you kind of need to think about these probabilities. So when there's in quantum theory, like with there's a kind of a symmetry to these. So it's when you think of you have to make the distinction between the kind of probability theory where you do lots and lots and lots of tests. So like the kind of the 50%, 50% of them come up, spin up, and 50% of them come down. Where we tend to think of this in terms of the frequentist's notion of probability, where you do something over and over and over again. And if you have that kind of view of probability, then this picture is not going to work, because there's only actually one measurement when things are actualized. But if you think of probability in a kind of a more kind of a sort of natural sense, like when you have like a coin, that's a 50% chance that it comes up heads and 50% chance that it comes up tails. Well, we don't need to throw a coin sort of a million times and then count the number of times it comes up heads and count the number of times it comes up tails. But really, we guys need to kind of consider the symmetry of the situation. That just by we see that there's a symmetry in it, and so that's how we think of it. And so really we're kind of looking at a symmetry in reality that we don't have to kind of make lots and lots and lots of measurements to choose one of these, but rather we see that there's nothing in the state that determines it to one state rather than another. I don't know whether that's what you're getting at, but that's how you have to be have a sort of certain notion of probability for this to work. And in a way, because there are kind of problems with Kent's interpretation if you don't have this this interpretation of probability that they say. So there are some criticisms of Kent's work. So I'm trying to say that you have to be careful what you actually mean by probability. I think you have to kind of think about really probability, just think about the symmetry of the situation rather than doing a test many, many, many times, because you're not doing a test many, many times, you're just making one single selection out of all your possibilities.
So unfortunately, that is 9:45. Okay. So let's thank Father Vero for coming.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Think Theism is made in association with Rasha Christi at Texas A&M University. We invite you to join the weekly Rasha Christi meetings every Thursday at 8:30 p.m. The views and opinions that are expressed in all of our episodes are of the speakers only and are not necessarily endorsed by Rasha Christi nor by Texas A&M University. For more information, go to thinktheism.org.